From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It reminds me of the people outrage in my case, Anthony Byers, when he was murdered by Francis Lavoti. The technicality that they said it happened in my case. This is the same thing, a repeat of what happened.
A federal appeals court overturns the conviction of three white police officers charged with brutalizing Abner Louima. Today, Democracy Now! Takes a look at the face of police brutality with Iris Baez, a mother of a victim of police brutality. Then, as President Bush finishes a whirlwind series of meetings with three African leaders, we'll look at global apartheid. And the Colombian government declares war in a large part of southern Colombia and expands special military powers. We'll talk with the husband of a woman who was just kidnapped by the FARC. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal court of appeals in New York overturned the conviction of three white police officers in the Abner Louima torture case, saying there was insufficient evidence they obstructed justice. Abner Louima is a Haitian immigrant. He was tortured in a police station bathroom following his arrest outside a Brooklyn nightclub on August 9, 1997. Louima's attorney says he's calling on the federal government to reopen the prosecution. As Free Speech Radio news correspondent Jeff Brady reports from New York, many activists are outraged and planning protests.
Civil rights advocates were quick to condemn the rulings overturning the convictions of three officers accused of torturing Abner Louima in the 70th precinct of a Brooklyn police station.
The fight is not over. We intend to meet Schwartz in court.
The Reverend Al Sharpton at a press conference today says Officer Justin Volpe did not act alone. Volpe pled guilty for sodomizing Louima and was sentenced to 30 years.
We intend to pursue the charges that can still stand against the others, and we intend to let the world know that Mr. Volpe's confession validated forever that Abner Louima did not lie. We cannot allow one man to take a fall when clearly one man could not have operated alone. And clearly, this is something that impedes the faith of people in the criminal justice system and in the process in these United States.
It's now up to federal prosecutors to retry officers Charles Schwartz, Thomas Weiss, and Thomas Bruder, whose convictions for criminal conspiracy were overturned by the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Eric Adams, with 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement, says he sees a pattern in high-profile police brutality cases.
The court system waits a while until things cool off and then find a creative way to free those who were convicted in the lower court. I think that Justin Volpe, if he did not admit his guilt in court, I believe he also would have been walking free earlier than what he's going to walk free in the future.
Sanford Rubenstein, Louima's attorney, says the Court of Appeals dealt with two cases. The first, regarding civil rights violations during the assault, will definitely be retried. The second was the decision of the Court of Appeals overturning the convictions of three policemen's conspiracies to obstruct justice. Rubenstein says this is not subject to appeal.
And they also ruled, with regard to the civil rights conviction of Officer Schwartz, that he was denied effective assistance of counsel. That may have something to do with the fact that his lawyer was a lawyer not only for him, but also for the Police Benevolent Union, and also that the jury was exposed to prejudicial information during deliberations.
Reverend Sharpton is calling on lawmakers involved in appointing a new prosecutor to ensure the case is handled differently. Rubenstein says that he's concerned that a new U.S. attorney may be appointed to the retrial by George Bush or John Ashcroft.
Alan Weingrad, the U.S. attorney for this district, tried the case personally, and he is a Democrat, I believe, and the Republicans in the Justice Department may decide to appoint a new U.S. attorney. If that happens, the community is very concerned that whoever is appointed as a prosecutor be as aggressive in their prosecution as Alan Weingrad was initially.
Louima's sodomy occurred under the term of former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who boasted on the toughness of the police department. New York's new mayor, Michael Bloomberg, was asked about the decision during his daily press briefing at City Hall.
I haven't read the decision, and until you read it, I don't know how you could have a reaction on what basis it was overturned and whether or not there is recourse. I just don't know, nor does Zachary Carter. It's just too early to tell.
Protests against the reversals of the convictions are being planned. Meanwhile, Louima's attorney, Sanford Rubenstein, says his client, who now lives in Florida, has no comment. Rubenstein says he will wait for the U.S. Attorney's Office to set the date for a retrial. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeff Brady in New York.
In a report to be released today, an environmental group is charging the Food and Drug Administration softened its warning to pregnant women about the dangers of mercury in some fish, notably tuna, and those changes were made under industry pressure, softening the warnings to pregnant women. The FDA rejects the charge. A 2000 National Academy of Sciences report estimates 60,000 women nationwide are putting their fetuses at risk of brain damage because of mercury in the fish they eat. Last year, the FDA warned pregnant women not to eat shark, swordfish, king mackerel, or tilefish, but the agency said they could eat to up to 12 ounces, equal to 2 cans of tuna, of any fish weekly, potentially exposing them to mercury levels that the NAS report deemed dangerous. The Environmental Working Group, an organization best known for raising concerns about pesticides, obtained more than 1,000 pages of FDA transcripts from focus group meetings with consumers conducted 2 years ago to test safety message about mercury and fish. The working group officials say FDA scientists told participants that following agency's advice wouldn't protect a fetus from harm. And this life and news and life and death story, as well as on today's USA Today front page, and involves the third row seats in SUVs. The piece says, imagine a seat that is flimsy in the third row, inches from the rear glass, as in today's sports utility vehicles and car SUV crossover models. The kids are buckled up back there. You're stopped at a light, and a drunk doesn't notice and rear ends you at 30 or 40 or 50 miles an hour. The result is frightening to contemplate. Chances of that happening are growing fast because third row seats have become a must-have feature in millions of vehicles. To meet customer demand, third rows are being squeezed wholesale into both SUVs and crossovers barely long enough to accommodate them, leaving mere inches between the seat and the back of the vehicle. And this news from India. Troops started moving into flashpoints in India's western state of Gujarat today after the worst flare-up of religious violence in the country in a decade killed nearly 200 people. Witnesses reported scattered incidents in the state's largest city of Ahmedabad, where angry Hindus killed scores of Muslims in reprisals for a Wednesday attack on a train in which 58 Hindus, many of whom were women and children, were burned alive. A police officer said the toll is expected to rise as more bodies are recovered and violence flares. Hospital officials said more than 110 people have been killed there, with at least 149 injured in stabbings.
I defy the system that made the coward, that pulled the trigger, that caused you not to be. The system of hate still haunts the ones you called your own. I defy this system with my spirit, flesh, and bone. I slay the system with my tongue, actions, and deeds. I stand tall, helping black people off of their knees. Kissing the system leads to breeds of filth and ignorance in the form of handouts in black face, while white faces show false pride, slip and slide, and hide behind white lies. Mecca, Mecca, Mecca. Your soul echoes through bottle trees. Fall from Mississippi winds to the crown of my head, releasing all fear. Sit me up. Turn me loose. These words I see. These words I hear. How close can your soul be? Brother Charles over airwaves keeps alive your memory. Sister Murley fought for justice for 30 years and won. Cowards can never hide behind the evil they have done.
Medgar's last words, Joviet Anderson, at the end of a rope in Mississippi, poetry and spoken word, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. In a shocking reversal A federal appeals court on Thursday overturned the convictions of three white police officers charged in the 1997 torture case of Abner Louima. The officers, Charles Schwarz, Thomas Weiss, and Thomas Bruder, had all been found guilty in an earlier ruling of brutalizing the Haitian immigrant. All had been sentenced to prison. Schwarz to 16 years for holding down Louima, while Officer Justin Volpe sodomized him with a broken broomstick, and Bruder and Weiss to 5 years for conspiracy to obstruct justice. But now it looks like the two of the men will go free, and the third might. According to Thursday's court decision, the first trials of Weiss and Bruder did not present sufficient evidence to convict them of a crime. As for Schwarz, the judges ruled he was denied effective counsel in his initial case. Also said some members of the jury were exposed to outside information during their deliberations that could have influenced their decision. The ruling is yet another stunning twist in a case that has become a national symbol of police brutality and ignited one of the first waves of protest against the Giuliani administration and the New York Police Department. Through successful prosecution, it's also one of the first cases to crack the blue wall of silence that long protected officers at the expense of justice. But as the reversal suggests, the legacy of this case is far from over. We're joined on the telephone now by Michael Ratner. He's an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael, can you begin by explaining what are the technicalities on which these reversals took place?
Well, they were surprising to me, and although I haven't read the whole decision, some of them just strike me as very peculiar. In Schwartz's case, who was convicted, of course, of holding down Louima, they claimed that there was a conflict because his lawyer represented him as well as the Patrolman Benevolent Association, the PBA. And they claimed that because of that, the lawyer had an interest in not having anyone else accused in the PBA of being involved in the crime, and that presented a conflict with regard to his representation of Schwarz. Now, the interesting thing about that is that they don't appear to have questioned the evidence about Schwarz holding down Louima, and Schwarz also waived any conflict, which you're generally allowed to do. They had recognized early in the trial that there might be a conflict because of that issue, and he waived it on the record. And despite that, and despite the evidence in the case, they overturned that verdict. So, as you said, he can be tried again for that crime in federal court, and most likely will be with a different lawyer, but it still is, considering the amount of evidence in the case and the fact that he'd waived it, it's a pretty surprising verdict.
Michael Ratner, this issue of the, quote, severe conflict where you had Schwarz's lawyer, the man accused of holding down Louima, also representing the Patrolman's Benevolent Association. In many of these cases, in a minute we're going to be speaking with one of the mothers of yet another police brutality victim. They have to take on not only the police department and the police officers, but this police union.
Right, that's right. I mean, you had a situation where they were really seeing him as part of the union, and the lawyers had been paid a lot of money to defend both the PBA and to defend Schwarz. But it does seem to me in this case, first of all, they were obviously a well-funded defense. The evidence, as I said, was quite overwhelming. And despite that, despite a really well-funded defense, despite, as I said, a waiver of the actual conflict, the Court of Appeals overturned it. Obviously, there was, you know, there's some conflict, but whether it was of a nature to overturn that kind of evidence in a case with a waiver seems very unlikely to me.
We're also joined in the studio by Iris Baez. She's the mother of Anthony Baez. And, well, Iris Baez, maybe you can briefly tell us what happened to your son as you continue to wear his button everywhere you go.
I can't take it off. This is a symbol that justice was not done like a lot of people think. Though Lavoie is in jail, he's not in jail for murdering my son.
And Francis Lavoie is the
Francis
man
Lavoie,
who killed your son.
Was the not a police officer. He's a, you know, a cop who didn't deserve to be in uniform. And this man chose to murder my son when my husband was begging to let him go. So they said it wasn't intent, But it was intent. When somebody's telling you to let go and you don't let go, that means you choose to murder them.
Let's go back to that day. The year?
1994.
And
December
this was right
22nd.
Around Christmas. Your kids were playing outside, playing ball outside.
Yes, they were playing football. The four brothers were playing football in front of my house.
And it was late at night. It was one of the last times they were going to be together.
11:30, 12, because at 4 o'clock in the morning they were heading for Florida.
And they were playing ball. There were police officers who were parked drinking coffee.
Yes, in front of the house by the fire hydrant. And Francis Lavotti's car came and parked parallel to that one. That's when the kids were playing football, and they threw the football. And one of the football ricocheted from the floor to the bumper of the car, and Francis Lavotti came out.
And first attacked another of your sons.
Yes. First he verbally abused them. Then he went back to the car. Then the kids moved away from the cars, kept on playing. Then he went where the kids were, and he told them that he didn't want them in that neighborhood. And then they said, but you know, we live here. Where are we going to go? So then Francis Lavotti grabbed David Baez and threw
Your
him
other
against
son.
The car. Yes, my youngest son. He was 16 at the time. Threw him against the car and arrested him for nothing. And then the other kid said, well, don't worry. We're going to go to the prison. We'll be there. And then that's when he came back and grabbed, pushed Anthony against the car. And Anthony ricocheted, and like he was falling back. And that's when he grabbed him.
And put him in a stranglehold.
Put him in a chokehold. And that's when my husband, everybody was screaming. So my husband came running down in his shorts. And he saw when Lavotti had him. And then the other police officers that were there told him, don't intervene. Don't get near the police. Get away or we'll arrest you. And then the other, there was another police officer with my other son. And then so because Raymond had a surgery done to his neck. My husband ran to Raymond to try to protect him too, because he had surgery in his neck. So then all this was happening. In the meantime, there were three other police officers there who was not doing nothing. There was a sergeant and two other officers before the fourth car came.
And your son suffered from asthma.
Well, he had a little condition of asthma. You know, that was never denied. He did have a little condition of asthma, but it had been 10 years that he haven't had an attack of asthma until that day that they wanted to prove that it was asthma who caused his death. But it was not asthma. It was pressure put on him that we proved that it was that.
And so what happened exactly to Francis Lavotti, the police officer? Your case became a notorious case. Your son... everyone loved him. He worked at a church camp as a mediator. He had come even to rescue your younger son just to say, please let him go when they took him,
yes.
When Lavotti went after him. No one could deny it. In no way could the mayor, Giuliani, besmirch him in any way. And yet...
They tried.
Yeah. And so what happened to Lavotti in the trial?
Well, we had three different trials because in the first one, a judge threw it out. Barton Roberts, he threw it out. He said Tony died of asthma. In the second time around, they brought it to the grand jury. Then they said that there was a technicality, and they threw it out again. And then the judge said there was a nest of perjuries on the trial. So he threw it out again and let Lavotti go. That's when the federal stepped in. But to this day, the federal hasn't done nothing to the other officers and the sergeant that was there.
But in terms of Lavotti himself?
Well, Lavotti got sentenced for violating his rights. But if I look at it, he violated David's right when he arrested him for nothing. He violated Henry's right when he arrested him, too. So what happened to their rights? Their rights don't count.
And so for that arrest, for the conviction of violating Anthony.
Only Anthony.
Who he killed, his civil mm-hmm. rights. What was he sentenced to?
He was sentenced to 7 years.
What is your reaction to this turnaround right now? The three-judge panel that has ruled that the convictions in the Abner Louima torture case are overturned against
the
three.
This is the game that the police, the Police Brutality Association play. you know, this is the
PBA. A play on PBA.
Yes.
The Police
they play
Patrolman's
these
Benevolent
games
Association.
In court, and they make these technical mistakes, so then they could come back and free these cops, which they know, you know, I mean, the cops themselves should know who is guilty and who is not. And the ones that are good, that get up in the morning and want to do their job, if they cover up for these brutal cops, then, you know, they should pay the price.
You founded an organization. You have been leading mothers of the disappeared, mothers of victims of police brutality now for years, standing up at town hall meetings, all of you showing the pictures of your sons, demanding justice. Has it
well,
made
you
a difference?
See, it's made very little difference. But if you don't keep on being the voices of the voiceless, then what's the sense of, you know, bringing kids into this world?
On that note, I want to thank you very much, Iris Baez, mother of Anthony Baez. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Rocky by Oliver Mutukudzi from African Odyssey, Putumayo CD. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to news that gets very little attention in the United States, it's news of the continent of Africa. In fact, this week, President Bush met with three major African leaders. The president of Angola came to Washington. Bush met with the president of Botswana. And he met with the president of Mozambique. Today, we're going to talk about Africa and globalization. And we're joined by Patrick Bond. He is the author of Zimbabwe's Plunge, as well as Against Global Apartheid. He joins us in our Firehouse studio yesterday for an extended interview. And I began by asking him about the recent trip of the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, to the World Economic Forum that took place at the Waldorf Astoria at the end of last month, the end of January, the beginning of February. I asked him what Thabo Mbeki was doing at the Waldorf Astoria.
He's been establishing relations with the G8 and the IMF, World Bank, WTO, all of the global elites, sort of spectacularly since about May 2000, very, very important one-on-one meetings with then-President Clinton, and then has been wooing the EU, Japan, and the other big leaders, really to get more aid flows and a little bit of debt relief and some commitments on investment and technology transfer to Africa. At least this is what's being argued. This is the new Partnership for Africa's Development. It was formally launched in October last year, and it's an attempt to bring the kind of classic so-called sort of Western values of good governance and market-oriented economies together. The problem is that it falls apart upon a very quick reading.
In what way?
The main things that are critics are raising are the hypocrisy in relation to the promotion of democracy, because just in the last few weeks, Amy, there's been stolen elections in Zambia, hotly contested in Madagascar, and one that's being stolen as we speak in Zimbabwe, because the government there is undermining one person of free and fair elections. But beyond sort of just ordinary one person, one vote just beyond the electoral project, is that the neoliberal economic strategies, the old structural adjustment programs, attempts to privatize electricity and water and other infrastructure across the continent, these have been tried for, decades, you could say, but certainly since 1980 in a big way. And it really, NEPAD represents a sort of rewriting of these. Homegrown, an African leader with some charisma, some huge problems like his AIDS policies, but an attempt really to elevate this man, Thabo Mbeki, and the people around him, to perhaps save some legitimacy for the G8, since after all, they're running the system that is really marginalizing systematically Africa.
And when you talk about the G8, you mean...
Well, it's really the leaders who meet and who are responsible for the big banks and corporations, the international financial institutions, for the structured, uneven development of the world economy. So the group of 8 largest industrial countries, their last meeting was the site in Genoa, of course, of 300,000 protesters. And Mbeki was there as well with a couple of other African leaders he's working with closely, Olusegun Obasanjo from Nigeria and Abdelaziz Bouteflika from Algeria. And those three are the troika that's trying to give really the G8 a way to save some face and throw a little bit more aid, some very highly conditional and unsatisfactory debt relief, and more free market trade. And that, of course, in Doha last year was another site where Mbeki just went along with the international elite's game plan to the detriment of Africa.
And now they've moved the G8 to a difficult to reach place in Canada.
That's right. And it's not just going to be physically hard to get out to the hills in Alberta, but psychologically, we can assume that Mbeki will be given a very high public platform. He'll be essentially telling protesters, don't worry, chaps, you know, go on back to your comfortable middle-class settings. I'm setting the agenda now for Africa. You don't need to worry about trying to promote the interests of third-world people. Leave it to me. That's the kind of role he's had, for example, at the World Conference Against Racism, the big UN conference last September, when civil society, the African-American community, even some African governments were demanding reparations for hundreds of years of colonialism, slavery, of apartheid, of neoliberalism. And Mbeki was a central figure in saying, no, don't worry, we can actually go ahead into the world economy on our own 2 feet without necessarily needing any reparations. So he has a very important intermediary function of sort of softening the progressive critiques of the world economy that come from the South.
Have people made the jokes about NEPAD's new partnership for Africa's development being NEPAD?
Indeed, you have to, if you're going to be putting out the begging bowl, get down on your knees. This is what you'll need, this thick document. But prior to that, it had a couple of other names. One was the MAP, and it was not a correct acronym for the Millennium Africa Recovery Plan. And then others would have heard of this from middle of 2001 as the New African Initiative. So they're changing names, bringing a few leaders in and out, but it really hasn't ever looked like it's going to be anything different than the same old Washington consensus and a little bit of rhetoric about democracy.
You talked about reparations and the Durban Conference obliterated certainly by September 11th, but even if those attacks hadn't happened, there was very little news of what happened in Durban. The fact that the U.S. had pulled out, many felt, whatever the reasons given, that it had much more to do with not wanting to deal with the transatlantic slave trade with reparations. I was wondering how much you know about banks, for example, Swiss banks and other countries' banks, and apartheid. We know a lot about Swiss banks and the Holocaust and other banks as well from other countries like Germany and German corporations, not to mention the German government and how it benefited. But what about apartheid and the slave trade?
And well, there are a couple of really excellent processes where financial institutions that profited from loans to apartheid and also that continue to profit from having illicit and mainly illegal financial relationships with current dictators or even recent like Sani Abacha in Nigeria. So campaigning against these institutions led by some extremely impressive South Africans. Let's take, for example, Archbishop Njungunkulu Ndengane. He regularly makes trips to Switzerland and he asks the Swiss banks, will you take 50 years to compensate us for your propping up the apartheid regime the way you did with Holocaust victims. And then the point is to show explicitly how, again and again, the Pretoria regime was bailed out as white ruled South Africa by Swiss banks, as well as U.S. and British banks. I mean, the U.S. and British banks were pressured by social movements, the students, the African American movement in this country, for many years. And by 1985, had pulled out. The Swiss banks came in to rescue them. So Archbishop Ndengani has made demands that there be a fund, not for the previous black victims of apartheid, but to have reconstruction and development. Interestingly, he's not necessarily trusting the South African government to run such a fund. As you know, there's a lot of concern from that progressive church side, as well as civil society, about the use of monies for purchase of arms, about $6 billion US of arms, and the very, very inadequate way AIDS is being dealt with. So, interestingly, this is civil society-driven demands for reparations, with a conception that the reparations really should be going to the people, not necessarily through a neoliberal government. And likewise, on banks which continue to hold the accounts of dictators. The one tiny silver lining in this dreadful September 11 incident, which so strengthened the forces of reaction all around the world, was that at least it looks impossible for any corrupt dictator to say, I've got my money in Cayman Islands or Panama or Jersey, Guernsey, whatever, these money center, offshore money centers, because when Al-Qaeda's funds were identified as being located in these places, and when about 23 offshore centers have been put on watch lists, and indeed, even when in Zimbabwe, the elite's money that's held offshore in these centers are now being targeted, it's now going to be harder for the most venal and corrupt of the international elites to try to work closely with London, Swiss, even U.S. banks to hide their money. So these are two simultaneous processes, and campaigning is going very well. I mean, Citibank, for example, is a big target of campaigners, starting with Rainforest Action Network and community groups in the Bronx. And so it's a really excellent site to mix all of the various complaints and grievances people legitimately have against the banks.
And Citigroup, its relation to apartheid?
Well, Citi was one of the stalwart lenders. They were one of the institutions that helped to put white South African capital deep into the mines, and had funded for many decades apartheid, particularly when the church movement in this, especially in New York City, began to contest this with shareholder resolutions. But you could even say when the old student movement, SDS, was protesting, when Martin Luther King called for the banks not to lend, when Chief Albert Luthuli of the ANC really led those calls in the 1960s, we began to get some of the seeds of the progressive anti-corporate globalization movement, the sense that these corporates are running around the world, these banks are lending to the most venal evil regimes like apartheid. And I think that's been one of the great experiences of maybe the last 30, 40 years in political activism, is that people can now really tackle the major institutions of international capitalism one by one, look at them surgically, move beyond rhetoric, and really say, no, you did this damage, and you owe the people that you hurt.
We're talking to economist and author Patrick Bond, who is just returning to South Africa. There's a very good film called Globalization in Africa, Which Side Are We On? And there's a part of it where the Belgian foreign minister is talking about the issue of, well, I thought he was going to talk about reparations, but let's listen to what he had to say about why Belgium is not culpable, is not responsible for what happened in the past.
I like Africa. I like the African people. I like them really. Their generosity, their spirit, their culture. So I like them really sincerely. But I think in such a debate, you must have enough love for Africa to explain them. That of course, a big part of the fault is the fact of the past and of my community, Belgium in Congo, of course, in Rwanda, in Burundi. But now, time has come to say them, you are strong enough now also to take over a part of your own destiny. Of course colonialism has very bad aspects, of course. But in the time of colonialism, that could not be considered as, for instance, a crime against humanity. Because in that time, in Europe and in other countries, colonialism was a sign of economical good health.
That was the Belgian foreign minister talking about the fact that what Belgium's responsible for, say, in the Congo, were not crimes against humanity. Your response, Patrick Bond?
Well, it's interesting. That was a comment made in September in the heat of the negotiations where he was mandated by Europe to resist any calls for reparations and even a substantial apology. But interestingly, our movement has been capable of putting pressure on him. And last month, in February, Louis Michel, the Belgian foreign minister, did make an apology for Belgium's role in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. He was, of course, the heroic nationalist in the what's now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And when Mobutu Sese Seko and the CIA, of course, Dwight Eisenhower, had already signed a sort of death order on Lumumba, but whenever those people had killed Lumumba, Belgium had been involved. And so the pressure is rising to come to grips with this legacy. What's interesting about the quote of Michel is that, by saying colonialism is a reflection of our economic strength, there's no apology. There's a sense that this earlier wave of globalization was inevitable. There was no alternative. If you were going to be a strong country in Europe, you had to go and build your colonies. It's not that different from the sort of neo-colonial and globalization rhetoric of the present, that is to say Washington, the New York banks, London banks, Swiss and Tokyo and Frankfurt banks are all more or less saying the same thing. There is no alternative. And I think if we can just project a few decades ahead, our successors in this movement trying to make the arguments and resonate with the demands on the ground will come back to the same banks involved in the third world debt crisis and look at their successors and all the ways in which money has been looted from the third world through banking, through trade, unfair trade relations. And we'll be asking these questions. Who's going to be paying compensation for these Washington policies now? So one of the ways is to, as most of the southern social movements are saying, close down the World Bank, cancel the debt, and any leftover money from closing the bank and the IMF, selling all the gold in the IMF, should be given to compensating the many, many millions, billions of victims of the World Bank and IMF. The World Bank bonds boycott is one of the very, very practical things that your listeners can do to get involved at www.worldbankboycott.org to really defund these institutions and get the money back to the people whose it rightfully belongs to.
That's World Bank bonds as opposed to World Bank bonds.
That's right. A bond is how the World Bank raises about 80% of its money. They go to the bond market and issue World Bank bonds. And the point of that is that all of the municipalities and pension funds and universities and churches, any of the endowments and investment funds they have, probably are investing in various kinds of mutual funds and investment trusts that have World Bank bonds in those. And the point is not to necessarily sell them, because that wouldn't really affect the bank. The point is to make an announcement, as just happened this week with Milwaukee and last year with San Francisco, with Oakland, with Berkeley, that these major institutional investors will be told, do not put any of our money, we're socially conscious, we don't want to profit from poverty, don't put any of our money into new purchases of World Bank bonds. It won't cost these funds anything to say, we'll just rope them out of our investment portfolio.
I wanted to ask what you thought of the Swiss president's comments when he quoted Marx at the World Economic Forum. Again, this is a film from the video Globalization in Africa, Which Side Are We On? But it's not an actor. This is the real thing. This is one of those very much for corporate globalization, talking about the place of Marx in all of this, the Swiss president.
This is a brief greeting, but it does save us time. And we all know that time is money. Or to put it in somewhat nicer terms, all economy is an economy of time. In fact, these are the words of Karl Marx. And Karl Marx, I think, can be quoted since 1989 in Davos, and I don't think anybody would hold that against me, particularly as Karl Marx was an economist, and he was the proponent of the First International, and he was an early representative of globalization. And so he really was a putative forefather of the WEF.
There you have the Swiss president, and I wanted to ask what your comment is on that.
I think if you put that bit of quotation together with what we've seen just a month ago at the World Economic Forum in New York, self-flagellation seems to be in style for international elites, and I think that's a healthy phenomenon because it suggests that they really can't defend the trajectory of the world economy, the inequality, the environmental degradation, and they're now having to make an appearance of the kind of open-mindedness and the concessions. Maybe the best at this is George Soros, and he's one of the, in a way, most thoughtful autocritics. He can self-criticize the fact that he's made billions of dollars profit by other people's misery and speculating on currencies and putting pressure on governments to impose the kind of austerity and neoliberal policies that have harmed so many people.
Well, let's take a listen for a minute, also from the film, to Trevor Ngwane, who is the Soweto activist. Actually, a movie was made about him specifically, but in this, it's the video bridge that took place last year from Porto Alegre to Switzerland, where he condemned George Soros. And then Soros is interviewed by Ben Kasdan, the filmmaker, and he responds. This we start with Trevor Ngwane.
We still had a hope that liberation, freedom, would bring houses, would bring jobs, would bring proper health care, would bring good education for our people. But since our government got closer to people like George Soros, we have lost 1 million jobs. As I'm talking now, we had an outbreak of cholera because the government was forced by the likes of Soros to introduce privatization of basic services like water and electricity.
She actually has a point, because South Africa has to meet the requirements of international capital in order to attract capital, which you need in order to generate economic activity. So today, South Africa is very much in the hands of international capital.
And that's George Soros responding. Your response there,
well,
Patrick Bond.
Soros is fascinating because he does understand the untenability of some of his books talk about the crisis of global capitalism and the contradictions that are brought forward by this sort of laissez-faire totalitarianism, as he's even put it. And I think what's interesting there is that the concession that South Africa is in the hands of international capital, and of course Soros is one of Mbeki's advisors on a special investment advisory panel, means that really they've not got, although they can self-flagellate, quote Marx, pretend that they have some essential moral concern about poor people and the environment, they can't really solve it, because Soros isn't really talking about any fundamental changes, maybe a Tobin tax, some kind of tax on financial speculation. But really the limits of the elite's own imagination and own conception of what can be done to end the emergence of global apartheid and its intensification becomes very clear. And I think that's why this NEPAD, the New Partnership for Africa's Development, is a little bit of a last gasp perhaps, but certainly a breath of fresh air for international elites, because it lets an African say, just let's keep on doing what we're doing, more or less.
What do you think specifically needs to be done?
Well, I think the demands that are coming from the social movements, the labor movements, women's groups, churches, should be listened to very carefully. Now, those have been articulated in a series of conferences, but also in the practice of day-to-day struggle, the struggles against the privatization of water and electricity that stretch across the third world. In Africa, especially Jubilee, the big debt cancellation movement, has moved from simply saying, we'd like a little relief, to saying, we want this canceled, to saying we want reparations, to saying we want our governments to have a debtors' cartel to repudiate. And they're even saying we want this World Bank IMF to be shut down. It's like they're a big boot on the leadership's neck. And what the people of the North must do is to remove that boot by trying to defund and certainly continue protesting every few months. I think the next big protest is in April and certainly at the end of September this year. Hopefully those 100,000 or more protesters that couldn't make it last September because of the terrorist attack will be out on the streets in Washington.
In a couple of weeks, the North American Rhodes Scholars will be meeting at the Waldorf Astoria, the same place where the World Economic Forum took place. Do you think that the Rhodes Trust or Rhodes Scholars should be making reparations to South Africa, considering who they're named after, Cecil Rhodes, and all that he stands for and how he made his wealth?
I haven't been up to date on how that particular struggle is being understood and called by the people affected. It's interesting that occasionally through a Rhodes scholarship, a progressive will have access to Oxford to in fact, there's a hilarious title of a professor, the Oxford Rhodes Professor of Race Relations, and the last three of those professors have been quite progressive. In fact, one's a Marxist environmentalist. So it's strange how what was once perhaps a tradition of pure imperialist signaling, the Rhodes aura, and Rhodes had a little group around him that built up vast amounts of wealth. Over time, it's less that it's the name Rhodes. Nobody's really talking about getting Rhodes's grave in Zimbabwe and sending him back to England or to Cape Town where he
ruled
from.
Zimbabwe was the former Rhodesia, named for Rhodes and his wealth.
I think what's most important about that history is to look at the development not of maybe just one imperial figure, one with enormous power like Rhodes and a certain charisma, but to look at the system that he set up, because that's unfortunately the residue, that's the legacy of Rhodes, is that mining capital set up a migrant labor system that first and foremost required racist laws and gender discrimination so that it was African women, rural women, paying virtually everything they had so their men could go work in the mines at a price less than the cost of reproducing that labor. And that, unfortunately, with the end of apartheid, didn't end. That migrant labor system, the huge problems of HIV transmission that goes with that, the degradation of families, the lack of dignity associated with men living in hostels or simply being without their families for 11 months of the year, all of that is still part and parcel of capitalism in the new South Africa. That's the great regrettable aftermath of what Rhodes, with his big mineral and state complex, set up about a century ago.
The Rhodes Trust has just announced the Rhodes Mandela Scholarship.
Well, Mandela has unfortunately let his name be attached to a great many things, and one of the difficulties of the way in which the transition in South Africa happened was that white business really was liberated most of all, in fact. So Rhodes, if he's the representative of the white English-speaking capitalists in South Africa, as opposed to the Afrikaners who were running the state, Afrikaners were persuaded, get out of the state, let the ANC take over. But the deal is white capital gets to take its money away, which they're doing. The antecedents of the Rhodes Fortune Anglo-American Corporation, De Beers, they're not even headquartered financially in Johannesburg. They've moved to London in the last couple of years. And as a result, the rand, the South African currency, has crashed by 50% the last 2 years because of the profit and dividend outflow. So we've just seen a looting, really, of apartheid-era wealth. Unfortunately, because Mandela was suckered into agreeing to liberalize, to allow financial transactions to occur without exchange controls, to let the companies relocate overseas. And that's one of the great tragedies. You can go quite a long way on democratization of politics and deracialization at the elite level, but by not really doing anything to change distribution relations, most
Patrick
people in South
Bond,
Africa, in socioeconomic
Zimbabwe's
terms, are worse off now.
And against global of Cecil Rhodes, let's talk about modern-day Zimbabwe and the upcoming election. We
it's
spoke
very,
to
very
in our studios yesterday
tragedy
here at Democracy Now. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Oh, Bush administration.
Colombian government has picked up on the Bush administration's rhetoric of a so-called war on terrorism as it declares a war zone in a large part of southern Colombia, including areas just outside the capital, and expands military special powers. Colombian President Andrés Pastrana warned citizens to expect more terrorist attacks from rebels yesterday in his first televised address to the nation since breaking off peace talks with the FARC last week. Pastrana rejected a one-year deadline to swap guerrillas in state jails for hostages held by FARC, including several members of Congress. The FARC hostages include Ingrid Betancourt, a presidential candidate with the Small Oxygen Green Party. She was taken on Saturday as she tried to enter the former rebel safe haven, a Switzerland-sized chunk of territory in the south, which Pastrana ceded to the FARC as a peace gesture 4 years ago. But after the FARC hijacked a civilian airliner and kidnapped a high-level senator, Pastrana reclaimed the zone and called off peace talks. Backed by an Air Force bombing campaign, the Colombian military has moved in on the former enclave to reassert control over it. The FARC has emerged out of the jungle to step up attacks on power lines, knocking out power to more than 50 towns, mainly in southern Colombia. Today, activists in Bogota are holding a demonstration to call for the resumption of peace talks between the government and the FARC for the safe return of the hostages. We're joined by one of the organizers, the husband of Ingrid Betancourt, the FARC hostage. Juan Lecomte is with us, also a longtime human rights activist in Colombia. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you explain the latest situation with your wife, who has been taken hostage by the FARC rebels?
First of all, I would like to say that in Colombia there is not a true democracy. This is like a virtual democracy, because here the victims are the guilty. So, in the case of my wife, I have no idea what's going on. The government doesn't show up. The government doesn't talk with us. I have no idea what are they doing. And we have no news from the government. We have no news from the guerrillas.
How was Ingrid Betancourt taken?
Excuse me?
How was your wife taken? Explain exactly what happened, why she went into the rebel zone, and what has happened.
In the last municipal election 2 years ago, in this zone, the biggest city is called San Vicente. My wife, Patty, elect one of his members to be a mayor and half of the council. So those people start calling her last week because the military came. Some people disappeared, some people died. There were so human rights violations. So she tried to go over there to be with the people, because in the campaign she always says, I'm going to be with you in the good and in the bad. So she went over there because it was her duty. And the government, even the militaries, don't let her use the military helicopter they were using, like a bridge from a town close to San Vicente. So she decided to go by car.
And then what happened?
And then, like half an hour before she passed for that point, a CNN correspondent called Harris Whitbeck, I spoke with him on Monday. He passed through that point and nothing happened to him. And the guerrilla stopped my wife and they kidnapped her.
And what are they demanding now?
They are demanding, like, to do an exchange for her with the guerrillas prisoners who are in jail right now.
And what has been the government's response?
The government responded they're not going to do that, And the government said that Ingrid is guilty of her kidnapping. That is like a dictatorial statement. This is not a statement come from a true democracy. In a true democracy, the government has to be responsible for the citizens.
The president of Colombia, Pastrana, declaring the peace process dead, bombing the area the size of Switzerland and southern Colombia that was ceded to the rebels years ago, killing what just in the last few weeks scores of children. How does that weigh in here to the kidnapping of your wife by the rebels?
Yeah, that was the reason then why she went over there, because there were some civilian killings and there were some civilian disappear, and the mayor of the city is of her party, so she went over there because she saw it was her duty to go.
Your wife is running for president, traveled into the FARC area, lambasted the FARC for getting involved in the cocaine trade to finance its war, is known widely in Colombia for her outspoken criticism of the government, but polls put her near the bottom of a large field of candidates in the May 26 presidential election.
I don't get the question.
My question is, what made her decide to run for president, and what are you calling for now with her being a hostage?
I mean, like I say, this is not a true democracy. This is a virtual democracy. So my wife decided to run for president because the other candidates are not like clean, are not like they're not gonna be good for Colombia. So she decided to run, and we are in Colombia. There is a law because we have here 3,000 kidnapping a year. It's like more than half in the whole world. So the law says that even if you are in hostage, if you are not physically present, you can run for senator or even for president. So we are going to keep rolling the campaign. We have to do some changes in the campaign because Ingrid is not here at the moment. But we are going to go to the end, and people can vote for her for president.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Juan Lecomte, husband of Senator and Oxygen Green Party presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt, who is being held by the FARC. Do you have any idea now where she is being held, and has she been able to get any messages out?
No, we have no news. And that thing happened not in the zone of the peace talk, not that zone that you talk about, the area of Switzerland. It's like half an hour before by car, because she couldn't go in there. So she may is in some place outside that zone. We don't know where exactly.
You talk about your wife being one of thousands of people who've been kidnapped, certainly tens of thousands who have been killed in Colombia. How do you make that known as the international spotlight is now on her situation, because she is a more prominent figure than most people who are killed in Colombia?
I think we have to, the government and the guerrilla has to do like a humanitarian agreement to release her. That happened twice before. This is not a law. This is a humanitarian agreement. They did that last year with a policeman, a colonel from the policeman, who was very sick, and they did that like 3 years ago with some soldiers they captured in very south of Colombia near Ecuador. So I think the best way to go...
Juan Lecompte, husband of Senator and Oxygen Green Party presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt, kidnapped by the FARC on Saturday. And that does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Jeremy Scahill. Our engineer and music maestro is Anthony Sloan. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. You can also go to our website at www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from the studios of Downtown Community Television, a community media center just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Thanks for listening.